Mr. Watson, Real 11, we're talking about your time with doing a typical Lancaster bombing raid. We got to the landing. And you said off tape there that the problem came if the tyres had been punctured. Could you comment on that for us?
Well, burst tyre was very common because, of course, the flak burst them. And they usually leaked out. And so if one of them, one side was flat, when you didn't know it because it didn't look flat. All you got was a surprise when you suddenly found you couldn't, the pilot found he couldn't control the landing run of the aircraft. And this happened to us on two occasions, but on an occasion at Fiskerton, we swung violently off the runway on the Zed, and through the Fido piping, taking some of it with us, you know, the pipe was about that much off the ground.
About 18 inches.
18 off the ground. Took that with us. Luckily, it wasn't in flames at the time, but we took it with us and, of course, carried it across. And we ended up next to the direction finding operator's wagon. He had a wagon, towable thing, and he was listening and giving bearings. He had a directional aerial, and if you wanted a true bearing, you called up and he gave you the true bearing, so it helped with your position. And it ended there, and I ended up, there was a ladder going in the back of the truck, metal ladder, up to about this height, and a door coming in, and a chap was sitting close to it with his headphones on. And I stepped out of swung the turret round, crawled out onto his steps, opened the door, much to his astonishment, when he discovered the turret of a Lancaster outside his door. Yes, he sort of got a hell of a shock. So of course, anybody would.
What was the procedure on a more normal landing? So you got ashore, you'd pulled off. Mm-hmm. What happened next?
Taxi round in the dispersal. Then you were debriefed.
So what was the debriefing like? What exactly
happened?
Well,
you were caught, first of all, you got out to the aircraft, had a fag if you smoked, heaved a sigh.
You smoked, did you?
I did smoke at that time. Heave a sigh of relief, said, thank Christ, that's over. And sort of gathered, waiting for a transport. And the WAF and a three-tonner was usually coming round, picking up crews and taking them in, and then coming back for another lot. If you were lucky and you were early down, you got picked up. If not, you just hung about there until she'd finished carting people about. And I remember the rear gunner always got into the cab because it was, the engine was hot. You see, it was these trucks or the engine inside the cab. And because we were so frozen, usually, we got in. And there was a girl called Rosie. Oh, she was a lovely car. And she was a motherly sort, and she would give you a cuddle, you know, because you were cold, frozen, and been frightened to death. And she would, Rosie, go and give you a cuddle. Oh, Rosie. She was a motherly, I think she wasn't. She wasn't a young thing. She was about, I suppose, about 30 or so. Her husband was in the army.
So you got this lift back to the debriefing, in the same room?
Yes, it was a debriefing.
What was the debriefing like? What happened at the debriefing?
Wait a minute. No, the debriefing wasn't in the same hut. It was in the ops room, because there were tables in it, as distinct from the briefing room, which was a Nissen hut with chairs. This was tables set like this. like a nuffy tables. I suppose it was nuffy tables. And sat there, and there were WAF girls, volunteers, carrying round cups of coffee, and a WAF medical of the assistant who went round with a jug of brandy or rum or something. Brandy, I think it was, yeah. And she gave you a tot of brandy. Another lass came round and gave you a cup of coffee. You were really looked after there, because they were all volunteered to do it out of duty hours. You know, they weren't. They were volunteers. Did other jobs during the day, parachute packers and fitters and things. And the WAF Queen Bee used to be there. And was there girls, as she called them?
What would happen at the debriefing? What exactly?
Well, they had they had a lot of WAF intelligence officers who were really just there to take down the information, I suppose. And they recorded all the trip, any incidents, when, took the navigator's log, referred to it, and doing what you're doing, but on a minor scale, only the operations bit. You weren't interested in any of the byproducts. Where we saw aircraft, where we were attacked, whether we fired at them, what we saw. And if you saw, for example, four flamers or one flamer, when, the time, I suppose they tried to establish who it was, who was missing. I remember on occasion there were 14 missing, so they had a bit of a job trying to plot where they were. But I saw, they said, where did you see, when did you see them, how many were there and where were they, you know. And they'd get the navigator to tell the position where these were. And sometimes, of course, they got this information back from the French underground, because they crashed in France, some of them. They tried to tie it all together anyway to establish who. And whether we saw any, especially in daylights, did we see any bailing out? That was important, of course. And did we see the letter of the aircraft as it went down? But they were generally difficult to see. Because the letters were quite big. They were as big, you know, nearly as big as that window. So that helped them to identify who was missing. So you went through that, had your cup of coffee and brandy, yeah, whatever you wanted. Ovaltine, I remember, was there. You could have Ovaltine. And having done all that, you repaired to bed. Made your way to bed.
Now, there's one story I'd like you to tell that you were telling me while we were having a cup of coffee about one time when your sleep was disturbed. And your can you tell the whole story as if I'd not heard any of it before? So that was a good story, and it explained several things.
Yes. Well, I think we were in a hut in the first place, a wooden hut. Not a Nissen hut, but a wooden hut. Some of the permanent buildings of the station. And there was a crew called, a chap named Saslov, went missing later. And in fact, on that occasion, that operation. And in the corner, just inside the door, there was our flight engineer, Jimmy Grindley. And then there was, I think, bombing, and I was also on the opposite side. I think I did about five beds on each side, I think. And there was parts of both crews there. And Jimmy Grindley was a flight engineer. We all had a revolver. And the purpose of this revolver was, if you were bailed out and were threatened by any German civilians, you could hold them off with this revolver. And it was used on many occasions because they were going to lynch you, especially if they're in the middle of flaming houses and whatnot. And the German police and the German intelligence people didn't want that. They wanted to interrogate you and get as much information from you as possible. So the German police were told, you must not allow the civilians to do anything to these aircraft. We want them. It's very important.
So what happened on this heat?
On this occasion, Jimmy had his revolver in his holster, top of his bed. And he was fond of taking this out, you know, been to cowboy films, Buck Jones and all this stuff. And Jimmy was fond of this revolver nonsense. And he had, of course, he had it loaded, you see. But, and we'd just come back in the early hours of the morning from a long trip and were shagged out, been to bed. And this crew, another crew sharing the hut, hadn't come back. Now, at about 8:30, I suppose, or maybe earlier. Anyway, too early for us because we were scheduled to get a late breakfast, which was 9:00. And they reserved this for crews who came back late so they could get some sleep. And in comes this little pilot officer who was, I discovered later, was a junior accountant officer. And this chap was in an organization known as the... Chaired by the Committee of Adjustment, got it. The Committee of Adjustment is chaired by the Wing Commander Administration, consisting of his very junior SPROG officer who was detailed to do the work, who was in charge of policemen and the police, the officer in charge of police was on it, and the Wing Commander Administration was the chairman. I've already told you that. There was a padre and someone else concerned with the burial arrangements. Oh, the doctor, M.O., and someone else. I don't know who it was. Anyway, they were called the Committee of Adjustment. They adjusted, presumably, the relics of those who were casualties. And they also looked at the wills, kept the wills, and dealt with the next of kin of casualties. Now, we were returned from a trip, and as I say, we were in bed and didn't want to be disturbed, but in came this bloody... two SPs and this little pilot officer and another couple from the Committee of Adjustment. And they come in, and of course Jimmy at the corner was the first to be disturbed. And he said, what in the hell are you doing in here, you know, in his real Glaswegian accent. And we've just come back. He said, get out of here. You can come back later. And this little part. We are the Committee of Adjustment, and we've been sent here by the Wing Commander to take over the effects of the casualties. Those words to that effect. Jimmy says, I don't care who the hell you are. Get out of here. And the spokes says, no, I'm not going out of here until we've gathered the effects of the... Now, there were... Aussies in that crew, and the Aussies got Comfort cigarettes in big packs, and they shared them out with us, and they kept them in their locker. Each crew member had a locker to keep his gear in, his civilian clothes and anything else. And we strongly suspected that this committee adjustment had an end in view, right? And we weren't having anything of it. And Jimmy certainly wasn't. And so Jimmy says, get out of here, and suitable language. And this bloke stood up to him and said, no, they weren't. They were going to take all the effects out of the lockers. Jimmy said, no, you aren't. Get out. And get out or I'll shoot you. And the bloke said, joking sort of thing. Jimmy takes the revolver. He says, get out of here, you bugger, or I'll shoot you. Oh. I'll tell the wing commander. And I said, doesn't matter, get out of here. And the bloke said, so Jimmy said, get out of here, I'll blind shoot you. And the folk pulled it. Jimmy, bang, above the bloody door. And for some reason, there was a spare palliasse stuck above the couplings in the door. And the bullet went in. There was a fluff of K-pock or whatever. Anyway, this little bloke decided that discretion was the better part of valor, and he went away vowing to tell the group captain and everything else. And sure enough, he reported it. As soon as they were out the door, all of us out, lockers out, cigarettes out, because we knew that these buggers were taking these cigarettes, and because we'd seen them in the Nuffy with the American type cigarettes that came from the embassy, you see. So we knew that they were at it. So anyway, it was reported to Wing Commander Selleck. So Jimmy duly polished the toes of his shoes, which was always a prelude to...
I mentioned.
And wiped his shoes and his trousers and set off to Selleck. And Jimmy came back. What's the sentence, Jimmy? Oh, he says, no problem. He says, I have to go down to the shooting range and fire. He's notified the armourer, and he's going to go down there and supply pistol targets, and I'm to fire at least 4 magazines of pistol shots to improve my shooting. And the wing commander's going to ring up the wing commander administration, who's been concerning themselves about this incident, and tell him that he's taken effective action to the offence. So Jimmy departed down to the range and fired his practice shot. The wing commander said, well, you're not a very good shot, Jimmy. We'll have to see to that, and sent him to.
So it was just ignored.
Oh, yeah.
The next, I mean, so that basically was a raid. That was the sort of routine of a raid. I thought we'd now look at some of the things that actually happened that you might remember.
Yeah. We've covered a landing on top of another aircraft, haven't we, where the lights went off.
No, but the first attack you're on, did you remember your first one on Le Havre on daylight? That was September 10th, that was quite a big one, I think.
Oh, yeah.
What do you remember of that?
Well, I remember they withdrew the troops. It was after the... No, that wasn't the one.
10th of September, this is 1944.
That was before. They wanted to liberate the Channel ports so they could land supplies and troops as they advanced further into France and Germany. This was the second front was in operation. And they wanted to get Calais so that they didn't have to transport by land, because communications in France had been buggered up. And they wanted Calais and Dieppe and so on. And we were just across the channel from Dover in the cliffs. The Germans had excavated tunnels to supply big guns, and you could actually, they were shelling the Dover Straits, stopping the use of the Dover Straits, and they were shelling Dover. They're these huge guns, and they sent them up to the shells of high trajectory, and they were landing, making the port of Dover unusable. So the thing was, we've got to stop these, the gun emplacements. When we got airborne and were over the Dover Straits, we could look at these guns. You could look down the muzzles of the bloody things. You could see them, because the embrasures, of course, were open to allow the guns to fire across. So they were denying us, the Navy, the use of the Dover Straits to get out into the North Sea. They were having to go around.
What happened? What do you remember about?
Well, I remember seeing the gun muzzles. You could see them as we got, we were quite low, about 6,000 feet, I think, to start with, and we got down to, I don't know what we got down to, but we were pretty low, because we had to try and skid the bombs, if possible, into these embrasures. You could see the guns in the embrasures from over the Dover Channel. No problem at all. We're quite low level. And so we went in and dropped them as far as we could into these embrasures. And that stopped that caper.
So that was that. And then the next raid, I don't know whether you remember, the Frankfurt night raid, September the 12th. This is on the marshalling yards.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the start of, you know, a series of raids.
Yes.
On that. I don't imagine you remember all these raids one by one. And you're going to let the War Museum photocopy your Grand European Tour 1944 account. So that people can read that as well if they want to know.
Yeah.
But are there any particular instance you remember? There was an attack on a night fighter base in Holland, and the Meuse on the marshalling yards.
Uh-huh.
Are there any other particular instance you remember then?
Flick over and just give the targets and I'll maybe...
Well, Calais again, that was daylight only on September 24th.
Oh, I remember of it, Calais.
This is the second raid on... Calais. What do you remember of that?
No, just hold on a second. Is there another low-level ground raid?
I don't know, this one's on Calais, on gun positions and troops. Yes, it's low-level.
That's it.
You've got a few pages about it in here. What do you remember of that?
Well, I remember it was very low. I remember it's the first time that I knew German troops had a split in the back of their tunic. And the reason was because the blast of the bombs was blowing up the flap. An odd thing to remember. So it shows you how close we were to them. We were very low.
There's a lot of flak on that trip.
Oh, yeah. Yes, a hell of a lot of ground fire because we were low. We were getting bullet holes all over. The tailplane, I remember the tailplane on both sides of me. It was the turret, you know, the flat, and then the big. And it was as if somebody was taking a spike and going, you know, holes were appearing all round, and then one shattered the glass in the turret, the perspex. But it was just somebody was going, poink, 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 on a shot. And this was the bullets coming up. And I think I told you the sunlight, the beams were coming through the...
That's room. When that hole, that you know.
But I remember this because I was killing them because the poor devils, they couldn't. I was just taking the guns. I mean, you had a pattern of about 30 foot square, you see. And I was just taking the guns through them. And
you were firing at ground targets.
I could see them as clear. You see their faces looking at them. There were Tommy guns and rifles and everything shooting at us. It's just blotting them out, the poor buggers.
And
I mean, that's what you had to do, or they were doing it to you.
It seems that Jimmy got rather excited during this trip.
Oh, Jimmy. Shoot the bastards, he was saying. Shoot the bastards. Because, of course, he was so low, and face-to-face, almost contact with him.
And you were hitting the engine, and then on the H2S.
That's when I told you they blew that out. And the engine, it 88 shell hit the centre of the starboard and then just demolished the engine.
And you had a sudden dive and only just pulled out from the looks of things at 700 feet.
I just made out of that. And of course, the closer we got to the ground, the worse the when fire came.
One thing, communication in the thing, you were all linked up by... Oh. I forgot to mention that. Can you just tell us about that again?
He had a microphone, and on the microphone was a switch, on-off. And if you left it on, it got very irritable because you had the static in it. You know, it went... So if somebody left their mic on, somebody said, mic on, and then it would go off. But if you... they weren't as sophisticated as communications are these days with managers and all this nice, clear communication. There was this constant hiss if you left the mic on. So it was very irritating to the other members of the crew, so you switched it off. So the first thing, if you wanted to talk, was to switch your mic on. There were carbon mics, and of course they were susceptible to moisture, and the moisture of course froze, so you ended up with a blooming crackling noise.
So there were several of these. Another raid on Cape Greedy, another raid on Calais, although not possibly the one you know. It's just about the same thing. It's actually about the others.
Mm-hmm. And, I used to write to my parents and send them sometimes a paper with a cutting on it.
Yes, a little newspaper cuts. Mm-hmm. And Camor raids on Calais at daylight. That was quite a big thing.
Mm-hmm. They wanted the Channel ports to supply the troops, you see. As long as the Germans stopped them using the Channel ports.
And you seem to have got a lot of flak on those trips.
Yes, well, we're low level, you see. I mean, we're doing that. The height you see the airplanes flying around to join the circuit here, that was a height where.
And so, another raid on Saarbrücken. That's a night raid.
How long did it take? It tells you.
6 hours 20. Saarbrücken and then Stuttgart and Essen.
Mm-hmm. Essen was the Ruhr.
Anything about those? I mean, Saarbrücken, it says a rough trip. Do you remember anything about it? A lot of them would be routine, wouldn't they?
Yeah. They were never routine in the sense that there was always something happened, either to the aeroplane or to, you got caught up in something. But you expected anti-aircraft fire. What was the worst part of that was coning and predicted flak.
Well, tell me a bit more about predicted flak then.
Well, coning, as you can imagine, was where the batteries of searchlights, which were all interconnected by radio, and they also had inclinometers, I think they were called, which gave it an angle, and between them they could liaise to form a cone of searchlights. Now, when you got into the cone of searchlights, as you imagine, you've got three, sometimes more searchlights, all collaborating over the telephone, ground communications, so that your track, the direction you're flying in, is given along a whole series of searchlights. So one searchlight fixes on you, and another one, and another one. And not only that, they give your track, apparent direction,